Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? Jim Caruso, how are you?
I'm very well, Mr. Powell. How are things in California?
They are turning wonderful. The fence guys are here today, so hopefully there won't be a loud banging in the background as we're talking. Didn't know they were coming exactly during podcast recording time, but the landlord is always full of surprises.
No, it's, they time things well.
Exactly. Well, our guest today, Jim, is Matt Brazil. Matt is a non-resident fellow at the Jamestown Foundation and worked in Asia for over 20 years as a U.S. Army officer, as a diplomat, as a corporate security manager. He has taught Chinese and Asian history at the university level. He has studied Chinese politics at Berkeley, Harvard, and in Sydney. He is also the co-author of the 2019 book, Chinese Communist Espionage and Intelligence Primer. Hello, Matt, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to join you.
Well, Matt, yesterday's Wall Street Journal has an article that says that the scale of China's spying is overwhelming Western governments. And I'll read a couple of paragraphs for you. Beijing is conducting espionage activities on what Western governments say is an unprecedented scale, mobilizing security agencies, private companies, and Chinese civilians in its quest to undermine rival states and bolster the country's economy. Rarely does a week go by without a warning from Western intelligence agency about the threat that China presents. Last month alone, the FBI said a Chinese state-linked firm hacked 260,000 internet-connected devices, including cameras and routers in the U.S., Britain, France, Romania, and elsewhere. A congressional probe said Chinese cargo cranes used at U.S. seaports had embedded technology that could allow Beijing to secretly control them. And the U.S. government alleged that a former top aide to New York Governor Kathy Hochul, where Jim is right now, was a Chinese agent. And in fact, it's not just Western governments. In July, I interviewed Philippine Senator Risa Hontiveros for episode 19, and she described her committee's investigation into the mayor of a small Philippines city, Alice Guo, now in custody, who appears to have been planted from an early age to grow up in what seems almost like a Manchurian candidate scenario. So, Matt, what are we looking at here, and why should we care about it?
I think it's true that the scale is unprecedented as far as our own experience goes. And at the root of this is what Nigel Inkster, the former MI6 Director of Intelligence and Analysis, has said, that China is best viewed as an intelligence state because the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, does its best to enlist as much of society as possible in these efforts, whether they're counterespionage at home or intelligence gathering abroad. And I think what we're seeing here, in brief, is an attempt by Xi Jinping to return as much as possible to, when it comes to these things, when it comes to intelligence and counterespionage, to return to the Mao era when the state had totalitarian control over government, or rather over society. And it's a hard thing to do, because China is much more hooked up with the rest of the world now than it was then. And there's it's a society that's, of course, become modern with electronics and other aspects of today's society. And so it's harder to control. It's harder to necessarily make your message heard over all the other messages that are out there. But the Xi Jinping government and its party apparatus are doing a pretty good job.
So, Matt, what is the point of hoovering up so much data from this through this decentralized process of basically having every aspect of government and society as a potential spy?
Hoovering up all this data is valuable in a couple different ways that are immediately obvious. One is that the data can be used if you decide to try to recruit a foreigner to spy for China, either for blackmail purposes or to better understand their background as you decide to develop an individual and move toward a recruitment pitch. And the other is that China's understanding of foreign societies has always been troubled by an inward-looking stance. And this is not to say, by the way, that Chinese people don't know more about America than Americans know about China. That's for sure. In the many people I've met from China, both visitors here and when I lived there for 8 years, people I spoke with then, it's very clear that in general, Chinese people know a lot more about America than vice versa. But when it comes to interpreting what's going on, the Chinese Communist Party has been hobbled by its own communist doctrine. That is, they see inevitable movement forward toward socialism and toward communism as part of the historical process, and they see capitalist overlords mercilessly exploiting the workers, this sort of thing. They don't take into account, for example, unions, the Western political process, and so forth. They often misunderstand these things. They don't tend to understand, for example, that the New York Times is not Xinhua news agency. It's not a mouthpiece of the government. Many Chinese misunderstand that sort of thing. And so by hoovering up a lot of data, it's a step forward toward better understanding foreign societies.
So that doesn't sound like a terrible thing, right? I mean, you'd want them to understand our society if we were going to sort of understand one another. What is it? Now, we're talking specifically in this case, though, about spying. And you wrote a book all about the Ministry of State Security, right? Which for the United States, we have a spy agency, right? What makes the MSS special or different from what we do with the CIA or what the Brits do with MI6? Or what makes that, why is the MSS of more concern, or should it be of more concern than any other country's spy agency?
Well, while many of my friends here in the United States might argue with the idea that CIA and MI6, that is the Secret Intelligence Service, have ethical constructs under which they operate, I think that's true, at least to an extent. But MSS really does not. They'll do anything. Now, if you go to the International Spy Museum, for example, you'll see coffee mugs that say, deny everything, which is what the Chinese side does. And everybody does that. They always deny everything when their spies are caught. However, MSS does not seem to care whether or not their own officers sit in prison forever and rot until they die. We have examples such as Chi Mok, who was caught in the early 2000s after spying for 20 plus years in the United States as a non-official cover officer of the PLA, of the military. And we have Xu Yanjun, who was caught several years ago and still sits in prison. No prospect of being traded away to go back home to his wife and child.
And so, Matt, just very quickly, so this is something that during the Cold War, for example, we did this all the time, right? We would trade with the Soviets, spies back and forth, correct?
Yes. And it became almost a routine matter, as depicted in the Tom Hanks movie, Bridge of Spies. But beyond that, the larger question, I think, is transnational repression. The Chinese regime does its best, like apparently India does too, to find people overseas who are opposed to the regime and to convince them by hook or by crook to shut their mouths or to go back to China and be put on trial. by, for example, holding the children. There's a case of a man who's wanted overseas in China on criminal charges, and state security has detained his adult children, who one of whom is an American born American citizen, the other whom I think is naturalized. So in short, they'll do anything, and this stems from the way the Communist Party operates. The Communist Party does not limit itself to operating according to law. Rather, it uses the law to judge its opponents.
One thing I find particularly disturbing is the Chinese law that requires any company in China to turn over all information to the security services on demand, and effectively, wittingly or unwittingly, spy on their customers, their employees, whether in China or abroad. Is that an accurate description of what happens in China, or is this a concern?
This is something that's always been true, and since Mao's time. And when the intelligence and counter-espionage laws came out in the period between 2014 and 2017, a number of Western commentators sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, so what? They've been requiring people to cooperate like this ever since Mao's time. But the difference now is twofold. One is that it makes it clear what is required and what the punishments are, so that companies such as big companies, such as the one owned by Jack Ma, who was detained for a while because he did an IPO in the United States without the party's permission, so that big wheels like him know what's required, and they know that they're not above the law because they have connections or they've bribed officials or whatever. And the other is to inform younger people who grew up in the more permissive 1990s and early 2000s, who came of age then, that and who barely knew that state security existed, is to inform them of their responsibilities, because I've lost count of the number of times when I lived in China in the 90s and later in the aughts, the number of times that people who were native Chinese, if discussing some problem that they might be facing, would insist that they had constitutional rights, would insist that they had the right to be informed if a spouse was detained within 72 hours, that sort of thing. And they weren't propagandizing, they were sincere in the belief that they had these rights under the law. But in reality, what the party wants at any particular time is what prevails.
So as we talk about some of these young Chinese people, we have, of course, a number of students in the United States, a very large number of students coming from China. And recently we had this incident that I referred to earlier of five of them who up at the University of Michigan, who were detained and have now been charged with spying, essentially taking pictures of an American military base where there was an exercise going on involving the U.S. and Taiwan. I guess they were they first claimed to have been journalists, and then they claimed to have been stargazing. But a look at their phones indicated they had a bunch of pictures on them. What is this indicative of? What does this tell us about how China does spying? And, you know, I have no doubt that the vast majority of Chinese students are just that. What does it mean that this number of them have been detained for this activity?
It could be a couple things. They could have been overzealous amateurs, patriotic amateurs. And I think that there have been a couple of cases like that, including the woman who tried to get into Mar-a-Lago several years ago when Trump was president, carrying a couple phones and some USB sticks and so forth. that sort of thing It's up in the air, really, what was going on there. But I would counter that idea that these were patriotic, overzealous people with something else has been observed, not only by me, certainly, but by people I talk to who know more than I do about these matters. And that is that the training in state security, both for its officers and for the agents they recruit, is very uneven. Nigel Inkster, for example, has written that that the Russians were much more careful and are much more careful when they recruit an agent. They train them thoroughly. And that can be seen just by looking at the classic example of the Cambridge Five. They were well-trained individuals who had personal faults, certainly, but they did survive for a long time.
And sorry, Matt, the Cambridge Five, can you give us just a little more context on this?
Oh, sure. So the Cambridge Five were students at Cambridge during the mostly during the Great Depression period, and they were recruited by one of their number who had been recruited by the Russians to spy for Russia, and the method by which they were recruited was ideology, dissatisfaction with the capitalist system. The most famous of them was Kim Philby, who spied for Russia for a couple decades. He actually was sent to Washington by MI6. He was friends with a number of CIA people and was able to extract a lot of information that led to the deaths of agents inserted into places like Albania.
So you're saying the Michigan Five are not quite at the same level of professionalism as maybe the Cambridge Five?
It doesn't seem that way. It seems like either they were overenthusiastic amateurs or they were convinced by their own country's service to try to do what they were doing. And the reason that the second scenario is plausible is because of the uneven training, number one, that is given to their officers and agents. And number two, the fact that they don't seem to care if their people are caught.
So do you agree with the Wall Street Journal contention that Western governments are being overwhelmed by Chinese spying activity? And if so, what should be Western response?
Yeah, the numbers seem to speak for themselves. One of the problems with the FBI's occasional contention that they have hundreds of cases a year that pop up, more than two a day, one of the problems with that is that they don't differentiate between things that move forward as an actual case and something that's just closed because there's no sufficient evidence to continue. So they're just talking about open cases that are opened. But it is clear that, as the FBI director has said, that China's using a whole of society effort, that they have succeeded in moving beyond just foreign intelligence gathering. And by the way, the other unusual aspect is the acquisition of technology for Chinese companies that the military intelligence arms and state security engage in. So they've brought this to a peak, and instead of it's sort of like with the Secret Service, you know, the Secret Service, as we have heard in recent days, is overwhelmed by the number of people they have to protect now compared to 10 years ago. And they have not received additional funding, really. They have not received additional people. And so that leads to gaps. What else is new in government? So I think that, and of course now we have congressional hearings where members of Congress get their 15-second sound bites criticizing the Secret Service, and we don't get to hear about how they have not funded the Secret Service adequately. So the same problem, I think, exists when it comes to our own counterespionage efforts and our own intelligence efforts abroad. We're facing an era of unprecedented danger, really. We have to be careful we don't mess up our own society as we respond to this. 99.99999% of Chinese Americans are not spies. And indeed, we need Chinese Americans on side, because not only do they represent a highly educated sector of society and one that is very accomplished, but also we need Chinese linguists more now than we ever have. And we're not training them. And we especially need them, not only in the FBI, but in Homeland Security and in line agencies like the Commerce Department, which has the Office of Export Enforcement that does technology diversion investigations. We need people to be trained in these agencies, like the military trains its foreign area officers. They put them through a year for a master's program in Asian studies if they're doing China. And they give them sufficient language training to be able to operate in China. For some reason, other agencies don't do that, and it's because they haven't asked for the money or Congress isn't willing to give it.
Yeah.
And that situation really needs reform.
So, Matt, I want to turn a little bit to the question of hacking. It seems like almost a constant drumbeat of news stories about this hack or that hack. The most recent one, and I think this was the one that was referred to in this Wall Street Journal report, is Salt Typhoon, which apparently involved the hack of some internet service providers. They're very concerned about what is the scope and scale of hacking in other, Chinese hacking programs. How did they do it and why did they do it?
My friend Peter Mattis, the co-author of our book, has identified 2005 as the approximate time when the party state in China began moving toward the use of hacking on a big scale. And he has hypothesized, I think correctly, that this has become like a force multiplier, that it brought China from its rather middling status amongst intelligence agencies worldwide to one where they're a world-class set of agencies now, both military and civilian with state security. And so they've devoted a lot of resources to this. And indeed, it seems under Xi Jinping that the intelligence requirements given to the agencies, including to the Ministry of Public Security, which is the National Police, it seems as if the intelligence requirements given to these agencies have multiplied, because public security in particular, and also state security, have turned to hiring for-profit companies in China that have the technical capability to do world-class hacking, to go after information that is part of the intelligence requirements in the current time. And these intelligence requirements include keeping track for the public security, keeping track of the not only the dissidents and the minorities from particularly from Xinjiang and Tibet in your district where you're responsible, but keeping track also of their relatives abroad, and doing your best to stop those relatives from abroad, who are abroad, from organizing into what they would call anti-China efforts. And so this has led to people being given phone calls abroad from their relatives, and the relative is in a police station, and the relative is forced to urge whoever it is to stop writing negative things about China. And then the phone is passed over to a public security official who amplifies the warning. So the where people can read about this is if you web search Isoon, that's a small I, S-O-O-N, Isoon in Chengdu, C-H-E-N-G-D-U, Isoon in Chengdu. So Isoon in Chengdu is apparently a major contractor that is doing this kind of work. And there was a leak of documents back in February. I've written about this on spytalk.co and also at the Jamestown China Brief. And other people have written about this too, in particular a group called Natto Thoughts, you know, the Japanese fermented soybean stuff, N-A-T-T-O Thoughts. They've written a lot of really good stuff about these hundreds of documents that were exposed in a leak.
So staying on the hacking issue, my understanding is there's evidence of Chinese hacking to U.S. and Western utilities, electric companies, water companies, with the fear that they could disrupt or shut down service at some time. It used to be that this is sort of a mutually assured destruction type scenario where if they tried to do that to us, you would do it to them. Does this mean that sort of deterrence no longer works, or are we not able to penetrate their systems so it's one-sided?
I don't know enough about what we're doing to comment. And I just want to mention that I haven't had a security clearance since 1995.
Well, so, if you did know secrets, we'd certainly want you to tell us all about them on this public podcast.
Yeah, I think that hacking has opened up a new frontier for national level action, and one of those results is that countries realize that they can burrow into another country's system and prepare for the day when they'd want to disrupt utilities, et cetera. And indeed, as they sit around and discuss these things in their windowless rooms, they probably conclude, I mean, logically, they would probably conclude that if we don't prepare to do this, then we're intentionally disarming ourselves when the day comes, so that we can't even retaliate.
We hear a lot also about the United Front Work Department, and this is a different but related, I'm asking more than telling, a different but related effort to what China does through the MSS and its spy agencies. How, if so, how is it different?
Well, during the revolution, Mao called, that ended in the 1949 victory, Mao called United Front Work the party's magic weapon. And the reason for this was really United Front Work goes all the way back to Lenin and the Leninist governing and international relations concept, which tells party organizers that they should unite with people with whom they can unite against whoever the enemy is. And that's for the present day, whenever that present day is, and when that becomes less convenient or less useful, then of course you can discard it. But United Front Work is a longstanding Chinese communist practice. And the extent to which it's been integrated with intelligence operations, I think, requires further study. I can say, for example, going all the way back to 1937, when when Japan invaded China, that CCP intelligence officers, including a senior one named Li Kanong, were involved in doing United Front work to try to convince people on the nationalist side of the utility of uniting against Japan and stopping the internal civil war that had been going on. And the reason that I think intelligence people get involved in United Front work is because they have knowledge of the enemy, whoever the enemy is. They are able to, they probably have a foreign language. They are schooled at convincing people to do things they might not otherwise want to do. and so that brings us to the United Front Work Department, which is a important element of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee. It's called a department because it's one of the top-level subordinate entities under the CCP Central Committee. Other ones include the Organization Department, which is huge. It's the super HR on steroids for the Communist Party, and the Propaganda Department, which runs the media on behalf of the party. So the United Front Work Department has long been engaged in working with people who are not enemies, but would be at least somewhat sympathetic to having better relations with China and with the Communist Party. In his book, Spies and Lies, Alex Joske, an Australian scholar, J-O-S-K-E, Spies and Lies, does a lot of conflation of United Front work with intelligence work, and he's been criticized for that. But he might be right, because he lays out some pretty good evidence that that United Front and intelligence work are often done together, or they're coordinated. And indeed, it's possible, although not confirmed, that one of the bureaus in the Ministry of State Security has the function of coordinating operations with the United Front Work Department.
So, Matt, let's say you're the in charge of hiring for a company that does AI or quantum or hypersonics or something, and the best qualified individual for a job happens to be a mainland PRC citizen. What do you do?
I think you have to, first of all, talk to your corporate security people, whom I hope would be at a high professional level, and many of them are, particularly if they belong to the American Society of Industrial Security, or ASIS. So your corporate security professional will understand risk and how to express risk in a numerical score on any particular problem. And one of the mantras in the security world is that you can't mitigate threat, because threat always exists and you're not God, you know. But you can mitigate risk. You can mitigate how you respond to a threat. So we can't mitigate the threat of the Communist Party trying to and succeeding in enlisting the help of someone who works in a foreign company, either by appealing to their patriotism or by appealing to their desire to not have their grandparents locked up in jail and who are back in China. So that's a threat that you can't mitigate, but you can mitigate how you respond to it. You can decide how much information you want that person to know. You can decide, first of all, do you want to hire that person? You can do a thorough background check, which is possible. There are people who do background checks on people who are from China. there's a false presumption that a background check on somebody who's from China is impossible, but it's been done. By doing a background check, you can see whether or not the risk is high. In other words, has that person worked for a state-owned enterprise or a government institute that works on the same kind of technology that you have? But you can probably never mitigate the risk that the Chinese state will go after the individual secretly by blackmailing relatives, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, that's become a real problem. It can be addressed in part if you're determined to hire somebody who carries that risk. It can be mitigated in part by having a candid conversation with the individual, and telling them, for example, one thing that you can tell them before they go home to China for Chinese New Year, for example, is if state security asks you for tea, as they often say, they drag you in and demand to know this and that. Tell them everything they want to know so that you can get out and come back and tell us what happened. Whether or not that particular tactic is a good idea would be up to the management.
So let's maybe, you know, bring this around to full circle. So the original article, and we talked about the New York the New York governor who had an individual in her office who has been charged with spying, and also this mystery mayor in the Philippines. Why does China target state and local officials in this way? What are they hoping to get out of that kind of activity?
Principally, they want to prevent the local government from official activity that recognizes or gives credit to China's opponents, principally Taiwan. The Dalai Lama, the Tibetan leader, and people who wish to bring up the abuses that have occurred in Xinjiang, which, by the way, have also occurred in Tibet. It's just that they've been less publicized. That's the big one, convincing, for example, a university not to invite the Dalai Lama to speak at a graduation ceremony or something like that. That's the big one.
All right. Well, Matt, I really want to thank you for educating us on this issue of Chinese espionage and, you know, really some unprecedented scale and scope as to that it's happening now. How should people who are interested in this topic follow along with your work?
Well, I have a website. It's mattbrazil.net. That's mattbrazil.net. I write for spytalk.co. I also write for the Jamestown China Brief, so that's jamestown.org. There's the book that's out from 2019. It was second edition 2022, Chinese Communist Espionage. And I'm working on another one that I hope to have done in about a year, less I hope, that is, unlike the handbook, which was mostly targeted toward law enforcement and China studies people, this next book that I'm working on now, draft title, The Darkest Red Corner, this next book will be about an overview of China's intelligence services written for the general public, the average reader.
Yeah. Well, Matt, we look forward to reading it, and we thank you for coming on.
So, Ray, does it ever occur to you that every time we get together, we talk about terrible problems without solutions?
Well, that's why that's what we do, right? That's how we roll. That's why I have a podcast and not a company. That's why we got out of government.
You know, it's funny. When I was in Australia last on the visit, we went to a university to their quantum computing department.
Yeah.
And they're describing their incredible cutting edge work and how they're working with their various secret agencies on this stuff. And I notice that a lot of folks working with them that are speaking Mandarin. So later on, I asked, are these Taiwanese or Australians? Said, no, they're from the PRC. I said, they're working on this stuff? Oh, yes. We couldn't afford to do it without their tuition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time. I was at the Stanford University, and there are a lot of Chinese students. And again, I know many of them. My wife and I kind of sponsored a couple of them. Yeah, I mean, we didn't pay for them, but we tried to help them along and invited them for Thanksgiving dinner and those kinds of things. I even taught one of them to drive. And again, you know, almost all of them perfectly lovely people who we'd be happy to know. I remember actually while we were in Australia, I went to a Chinese Australian church. These people were from all over. They were ethnically Chinese. Many of them are, you know, second, third, fourth generation Australians, but their ancestors may have come from China or Singapore or Malaysia or Hong Kong or Taiwan. I mean, many different places. And I remember I got into a discussion with some of them at one point, just over dinner, and said, you know, how does it affect you to have all of these things going on involving, you know, United Front work or espionage or things, and then you have, you know, Australian legislation and people? Do you get singled out? Do you get targeted? And, you know, of course, many of them were, you know, and of course, that's one of the awful things about this whole thing is that there are a ton of, as Matt mentioned, there are a ton of wonderful, patriotic American or Australian or wherever they're in people who have Chinese origins. And yet a lot of their problem begins with the fact that in the eyes of the Chinese Communist Party, they believe that overseas ethnic Chinese owe some allegiance back to the motherland, and they are acting on that belief. And, you know, that really causes a lot of wonderful people a lot of serious problems.
Right. Well, we as believers in our constitution, democracy, and individual rights always have to make sure that we're not judging a people. We're Amen. Judging an individual.
Amen. No, I mean, 1,000%. And we've all seen the examples of the other thing happening. And so 1,000%, I'm with you on that. And of course, you know, it hasn't always been thus, right? I mean, we haven't had this level of understanding. And of course, you know, if we look back in our own history, when we had a war with Japan, and we did some pretty awful things that we didn't do to German Americans, right? And so there is a tendency to go in that direction. We absolutely have to be careful about that, which means that we just need to be much better about dealing with the behavior, the illegal activity, and less, you know, concerned about, you know, what the ethnicity of the person actually doing it is.
Well, that said, as a pale male American, what's your story today?
Well, actually, I thought I should probably talk about a time when I was accused of hacking after a fashion. I was, as you know, stationed at the embassy in Vietnam for a few years. And as I was going around the country introducing myself to people who in their Air Force, because I was the air attaché, I went down to Nha Trang, which is where at the time they had their pilot training school. And so... My career field going back a few years in the Air Force was communications, right? Which was like, you know, you had a communications squadron, you took care of the phones and the computer networks and all of that stuff, you know, the radios and all of those things. But then as time advanced, we changed the name of it from communications to cyber operations. So as I'm sitting there in this big room talking to this Vietnamese commander of the pilot training school, and he looks at me and he asks me, so, and there are all of these other Vietnamese Air Force officers sitting around. He says, so, what is your background? And because they assumed that because I was there as the air attaché, I must be a pilot. I said, actually, I'm not a pilot. I don't fly planes. And they said, well, what do you do? I said, well, this badge here is for cyber operations. And they said, oh, a cyber hacker. And the whole place just sort of erupted. I'm like, no. That's not what that's for.
Well, of course, that makes you the worst spy ever when you announce it.
Yeah, well, of course, these days I'm always being accused of being a CIA spy for the work that I do in maritime transparency. And I often will say, if I am a spy, I'm the worst spy ever because I am very, very public person. This was at a time when cyber was just sort of a new buzzword and nobody could, and honestly, it's still kind of a buzzword. Nobody can really say where cyber starts and stops. It's kind of an ethereal concept. So that was the day that the Vietnamese thought I was a hacker.
Well, one day we will discuss all the incoherent fears and thoughts as technology moves faster than we brains can manage. But that's for another time.
Well, we already had that episode with Anshu Roy talking about artificial intelligence, and the closer I get to the world of AI, and I do find myself interacting with it more and more often now, the more I'm sort of grateful that I got to live most of my life before we got here, because it's also it's almost dizzying how fast things are moving.
Yes. I look at my 2-year-old granddaughter and I wonder, she's going to be knowing so much more or so much less than I do, depending on where the AI goes.
Exactly. Well, anyway, Jim, this has been a great podcast. Our producer, of course, as always, Ian Ellis Jones, who has his own media company, IEJ Media. Please follow him at Ian Ellis Jones on X. And of course, if you like us, you got to stop right now. Stop what you're doing. Hit the like or subscribe button. We really like it when you subscribe because that tells the world that you're following us. That gets us out there more. And of course, it means that you don't miss an episode. So please do that before you forget. If you are interested in the discussion we mentioned before with Senator Hontiveros from the Philippines talking about their own spy issue, that happened in the context of why should we care about China's criminal gaming syndicates, which was episode 19. So go back and look for that. And of course, follow us on our social media. Right now we're on LinkedIn and X. You can look us up there. And if you like audio podcasts like I do, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, we do all that stuff. And finally, thank you. Thank you for being part of our lives, and thank you for joining us. We'll talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.